Okay, let me start with a word of prayer. Dear Lord, our Heavenly Father, oh, you are heavenly. And Lord, we thank you that you are the Lord of history, that you declare the end from the beginning, and from ancient times things that have not yet been done, that you work all things after the counsel of your will, even of the heathens, of the pagans, of ancient Greece. I pray, dear Lord, that you would grant us understanding, help us to understand how ancient Greece fits into the flow of Western civilization, though they are pagans, heathens. I pray that you'd bless the class and use it for your glory and for the good of your church. In Christ's precious name we pray. Amen. Well, as we continue our course, America in Western Civilization, you know, we spent a couple classes with a broad introduction to ancient Greece. Today we're going to look at, Lord willing here, early Greek history and poets. And then the next time we meet, Lord willing, will be Greek mythology. So as you know, our journey through Western civilization began with Jerusalem, and now we are traveling through Athens in ancient Greece. Greece is located on the western side of the Aegean Sea. Kind of have a crude map here on the board. So the eastern Mediterranean is all this way, and this is on the north side, right? Africa's down here, and the promised land, Israel, over here, going east. But this is on the north, small island, Cyprus, over here. I did not put on the board, smaller than the island of Crete. The eastern Mediterranean Sea, then, is divided into smaller seas, to give you more specificity of what part of the Mediterranean Sea we're talking about. So, if Greece is in this region here, and this is the Aegean Sea, the Adriatic Sea is to the northwest of Greece. Ionian Sea is just west of Greece. West of the Adriatic and Ionian is Italy, what would become Italy. It's not there at this point in history in 1200 BC. Sicily is an island just south of Italy. There's a city there that'll be important, Syracuse, in history. You know, Macedonia is up more on the northwest side of the Aegean Sea, and that's where Alexander the Great will come out of in the 300s BC. Asia Minor is present-day Turkey. Pastor Ron's been dealing with that in the letter to the seven churches, right? Going through this area with the postal route in the Roman Empire. So hopefully we'll get there, right? Once we travel through Athens, then we'll get to Rome. This is where I hope as well, for every one of us as Christians, that we begin to have a greater understanding of the cultural context of the Greco-Roman world in which the New Testament was written, right? So we learn a little bit more of the geography, a little bit more of the culture and the history, philosophy, and the paganism. But at the time, it was Asia Minor. We'll talk about the civilizations that existed in this time. So some of the cities that are important that I put in here, so the lines are the sea, obviously, right? City of Troy is this on the northeast part of the Aegean Sea. Miletus, eastern part of the Aegean Sea. Athens is just there before the peninsula out onto the Peloponnese, the mainland of Greece. I'm going to talk about Mount Olympus is kind of up in this area. Mount Olympus, the highest mountain in Greece. And that plays a role, obviously, an important role with their Greek mythology that we'll get into. Mycenae is kind of in that neck of the woods within Greece. We're going to talk about that civilization. There's another one I did not write that is on Crete, an island there. This island Crete, the city, we'll put... which the K should be silent, Gnosis. And that's another city that's important within the Minoan civilization that's on Crete. So we'll talk about that. But that's kind of to give you a picture of this area of the Mediterranean Sea. This would curve on down, and then Israel, eventually what would become Israel, would be over in this neck of the woods on the eastern Mediterranean Sea. And then coming down, then you'd have the Nile River, right, going down, and you'd have Egypt along the Nile River. So that's a broad perspective of more early Greek history. There's other cities within Greece at this time. There'll be Thebes. Corinth goes way back as well, more in this neck of the woods where they're at. As you can see, Athens goes way back to the Mycenae civilization. So, the two periods of time of ancient Greek history, you know, obviously we've got to learn some history in all of this. And the Archaic Age and the Classical Age. They're the two ages in which they look at ancient Greece. The Archaic Age is from 750 to 500 BC. 750 to 500 BC, and we're going to talk about things that happened during that period of time. But just to get in your mind right now, the broad forest of kind of how things are divided up. The Classical Age of ancient Greece is from then 500, roughly 500 BC to 323 BC. And you can see the middle of that classical period is around 400 BC. And there's some who have said the Golden Age, the golden period of classical ancient Greek civilization is probably only about 50 years, maybe 450 to 400 BC, in the central part of that classical age. Okay? So again, the Archaic Age from 750 to 500 BC and the Classical Age of ancient Greece from 500 BC to 323 BC. To 323 BC gets us to the Hellenization of Alexander the Great when he died. Because he was trying to bring the Hellenes were the Greeks. They went by the term the Hellenes. So the Hellenization that Alexander the Great was trying to bring to the world, was trying to bring Greek culture. He was educated under one of the great philosophers of ancient Greece, Aristotle. Well, another way of looking at history, you know how it goes maybe to the from the Stone Age to the Bronze Age to the Iron Age, right? Various ages based on tools and weapons of war and what they were made out of. Well, the Bronze Age, I wrote that on the board here, the Bronze Age roughly goes from about 3300 BC to about 1200 BC. About 3300 BC to 1200 BC. And again, we're counting down, remember, in your mind, we're counting down. This is BC, is before Christ. So we're counting down to Christ. So as we're moving along in history, it's counting down, right? This is where I know I've had a Corinne ask me about that in the past. That's why I stress that. Keep that in your mind. Now, I'll just say this. This is not hard and fast on the Bronze Age, because historians, archaeologists know that bronze was used to some degree both before and after these periods. Think of the descendants of Cain early on using bronze mentioned in Genesis chapter 4, verse 22. Some of the descendants of Cain were craftsmen in bronze. So there you've got, more than likely before 3300 BC, the use of bronze. And the Vikings, you think we have our history, right? Minnesota Vikings? Well, the Nordic countries of the Scandinavian area, we had the Vikings. Warrior people, they used bronze instruments and tools of war. Well, the Vikings of the Nordic countries were late to enter the Bronze Age as well. They were late to move to the next age, the Iron Age. So they were late to get that technology within international trade and then use it, and then they were late to leave it and move on to the next technology of iron. So this is a broad Don't think nobody used bronze before 3300 BC and nobody used bronze after 1200 BC, okay? But this is a rough estimate of when it was predominantly used in civilizations of the known world, okay? You say, well, what is bronze? Bronze is made out of tin and copper. Bronze is made out of tin and copper, and typically goes along with permanent agricultural settlements, usually. Not always, but typically. Because it's tools for farming. It's a part of the bronze instruments. So this is where you're getting beyond just the hunter-gatherer society to a permanent settled agricultural society using the instruments to till the ground. And then obviously for instruments of war as well. So those of the Bronze Age were typically not nomadic hunters and gatherers, is another way of saying it, but primarily engaged in agriculture with permanent settlements. Now, in the late Bronze Age, so when we're getting close, counting down, getting close to 1200 BC, that's where certain settlements or cities in and around Greece were significant. And that's where I wrote on the map there, Troy, the city of Troy, on the northeast part of the Aegean Sea, across east of Greece, northeast of Greece, so Greece is here, across the Aegean Sea, we have the city of Troy. Also straight east, more or less, you got Miletus. Miletus is another city. Remember Thales? Right, we'll get to him. Father of ancient Greek philosophy. Right. Well, he was of Miletus. So the Greeks did conquer some of this area at one point. So this is where they'll be spreading their wings. And they were a warrior society as well. Another important city is Athens, right? Athens, Knossos here on Crete, the island of Crete, important city before 1200 BC. Mycenae is an important city within Greece. Before 1200 BC, in the Bronze Age, the civilizations that existed in the region had kings with huge palaces. Kings with huge palaces. And if you see maps of them, they're quite complex. Tons of different rooms. Many of them also functions at administrative agencies for their kingdoms. Okay? But they're all monarchies. And this is where, again, we'll be flowing. The reason that ancient Greece is a part of Western civilization is we learn about republican form of government. Right? Republican forms of government where you have people governing themselves, not being ruled by kings and monarchs, not subjects of a king, but citizens who govern themselves, who elect their own representatives to a certain extent. Okay? And some were democratic. I mean, this is where we learn things, and especially what not to do from the ancient Greeks with some of the problems they had with the various experiments with republican forms of government. But it's important to see is that early Greek history then, what was there was the Mycenae civilization that we'll get to, we'll talk about, that was centered in the city of Mycenae. But these were all monarchies with huge palaces at this time, at the end of the Bronze Age, before 1200 BC. The Minoan civilization was on the island of Crete, Knossos, huge palace. I do believe, I think I had read, it was like in the 1340s, I think the Mycenae civilization had defeated them, the Minoans, in the 1300s BC. But in the late Bronze Age, that was an important civilization with a huge palace. And this is something, you know, if you read your New Testament, Titus is connected with Crete, right? You remember that? And they didn't have the best reputation, right? But this is where, again, this is where you're thinking, this goes way back then. way back in the Greco-Roman history of what the people were there on Crete. But it was called the Minoan civilization, just to let you know, too, based on the mythical King Minos. It was a mythical king. In Rome, you will see with the founding of Rome, they had their own myths and stories about how Rome was founded in Italy. Once we get there. But the Minoan civilization had a myth of the King Minos. The Mycenaean civilization of Greece prospered in the city of Mycenae with Athens and other cities across Greece there that also had monarchical palace-based administrative systems with it. But that was a monarchy out of the city of Mycenae. It's interesting that even today, some of these exist. There's pictures of the Lion's Gate that was there at the palace of Mycenae. So they had huge walls and gates protected the palace. Huge walls and gates. So it was a military establishment ready for war with thick, and they were thick walls. And there's one that has these lions, and it's a thick gate. It was the main entrance to get into the palace. Another civilization at this time, at the late Bronze Age, was the Hittite civilization, and that governed across Asia Minor, going east across Asia Minor. And then the Egyptian civilization governed the region alongside the Nile River. So if we continue the map down across, then the Nile River going over here, and then Egypt going along the Nile River. And as you know, that was governed with the pharaohs, right? More of a monarchical type system. In all these civilizations, in each of these civilizations, they had vast redistributive economic systems. Okay, that's important, where you've got people that are just, they live life as serfs and slaves and subjects of the monarch, of the ruler, of the dictator. Of the single monarchy is the single ruler. And they lived as serfs and subjects of that monarch and depended upon the redistribution of the collective wealth of the king. Everything was owned by the king, ultimately, basically. And you know your history with Joseph, with Pharaoh in Egypt, storing up grain, right? But it helped immensely to collectivize the power in Pharaoh's hand, right? And redistributing all the wealth, food and necessities for the people. This is important because this is very different than what will happen in ancient Greece, where you will end up with people governing themselves, running their own family farms, growing their own olives, their own grapes, their own grains, selling them themselves, managing their own businesses, deciding when to wage war, very different, right? Okay, so I want you to see what existed beforehand. And there's in God's providence, there's all this, you'll be fascinated. It's an interesting history of how great change was brought about in this region of the world. But in each of these areas, the people were subjects and slaves, not considered citizens at all. Not considered citizens at all. Now, as you know, in Israel, once Israel forms, they originally had God as their king, their monarch, right? And then we know based on 1 Samuel chapter 8, they rejected God as their king, wanted an earthly king like the nations around them. We know, though, that they were not just subjects of a king, but they could also be regarded as citizens, right? We looked at all the characteristics of citizenship and how you could still see them, those characteristics of citizenship within ancient Israel. Okay? That's where it was a different society. Now, I want to put this in here just so you get a perspective about when did Israel's exodus from Egypt take place. There's two ideas on that. Okay? Two ideas on that. One idea is around 1450 BC. One idea is around 1450 BC. The other is around 1200 BC. Archaeological evidence tends to suggest 1200 BC. Okay. If you read 1 Kings chapter 6, verse 1, it says that 12 generations prior to Solomon beginning to build the temple is when the Israelites were brought out of slavery in Egypt. Now, the New King James does its translation and says 480th year. Now, it could be just translated the 12th generation. And the question is, how many years are there in a generation? Those who gave us the New King James translation assumed 40 years per generation, and therefore, for our English translation, put, and it came to pass in the 480th year after. Okay? Now that verse could be just translated into English in the 12th generation after. The children of Israel had come out of the land of Egypt in the fourth year of Solomon's reign after it. Over Israel in the month of Ziv, which is in the second month that he began to build the house of the Lord. Now, we know this is 966 B.C. Now, if I asked you and said, okay, what if the best translation is just to say 12th generation, and it came to pass in the 12th generation after the children of Israel had come out of the land of Egypt, and if I asked you and said, okay, how many years are there in a generation? Think about this a minute. When the Israelites were redeemed out of slavery in Egypt, first generation rebelled, right? Joshua and Caleb were the only two that got to go into the promised land. Of the second generation, what age? What age and under got to enter the promised land when they were redeemed out of slavery in Egypt? What do you think? So of the young children that had been redeemed out of slavery in Egypt, many of them got to still go in the promised land, right? They did. Age 20 and under. 20 and under. And those that were older, they didn't. They died in the wilderness, except Joshua and Caleb, right? Here's the issue. If you say, and it came to pass in the 12th generation after the children of Israel, if you look at generations as 20, every 20 years, children, at age 40, your grandparents, you keep pumping out kids, 20, 20, 20, 20, every 20 years. If you regard a generation as 20, so the Exodus is dated 12 generations prior to when Solomon began building the temple. And the question is, do you regard the generations 40 or 20? If you say 20, it totals 240 years. And where does that take you? To 1200 BC, not 1450 BC. If you take a generation as 40, then you're at 480, and that puts you at 1450. Follow me? What's fascinating to me, and I'll give you my argument to say, I understand both perspectives, but I actually think the 1200 makes more sense, and I'll explain why in a minute. With all that took place in this area of the world. But I want you to understand there is some debate on that, okay? You're going to see, why is 1200 BC so critical? Why is it so important? It's incredible, and I think this is why God brought them out at that time. He's doing something with all these other civilizations in the Eastern Mediterranean at that exact time. And I'll get to that in a minute, okay? Keep that in the back of your mind. I want to say a little bit about the religion at that time. A little bit about the religion. is at the end of the Bronze Age. So again, as we're approaching 1200 BC, from 1300 BC down to 1200 BC, the Mycenaean civilization had many gods and goddesses. As did the Minoan civilization on Crete, the Hittite civilization in Asia Minor, and the Egyptian civilization around the Nile River. Thomas Martin, a scholar on ancient Greece and that whole period of time, listen to what he said. I put down a paragraph of his I thought was fascinating. Because remember, what is a civilization? As we've said, it's the cultural characteristics of a people group. What's the culture? The cultural characteristic of a people is the cult, which means the overall religious worship and devotion of a people group, right? And then that determines their ethics, what they think is right and wrong, and the laws that they have, right? Well, this is what Thomas Martin says about the Mycenaeans, okay? And they're the ones, again, that basically dominate this whole area going into 1200 up in Greece, okay? And they dominate that area. Here's what he says. The Mycenaeans worshipped primarily the male-dominated pantheon, traditionally associated with the idea of an Indo-European warrior culture. The names of deities known from later Greek religion occur in the Linear B tablets. That was their language. Okay, they had different. Linear A, I think it was Linear B. At this point, Linear B. Mycenae civilization in Greece. So they had a written language. And they had certain deities written out on tablets, such as Hera, Zeus, Poseidon, Dionysus, as well as the names of divinities unknown in later times. Some were lost. The name or title Potnia, referring to a female divinity as mistress or ruler, is very common in the tablets, emphasizing the importance of goddesses in Bronze Age religion. So it was not just a male-dominated pantheon, but they had many goddesses as well, worshiping female idols. Okay? But some of the names will carry forward. This is what I'm trying to emphasize, is that you and I will not understand the culture of ancient Greece during the Archaic Age from 750 to 500 BC, or in the Classical Age of ancient Greece from 500 BC to 323 BC. We will not understand ancient Greece during these two ages unless we understand the culture of the Mycenae civilization that existed there prior to it, okay? That existed there before 1200 BC at the end of the Bronze Age, okay? Many of the gods and goddesses that they had in the Mycenae are carried over into the ancient Greek civilization of the Archaic period and the Classical period. Now, as you know, we've covered Romans 1, 18 to 32 in the Existence of God series on Wednesday night. So I wanted to say just a little bit on the evidence of all of this, right? It's good for us to remember. In every one of these civilizations, the Minoan civilization, the same thing, they had their gods and goddesses. The Hittite civilization had their various gods and goddesses. The Egyptian civilization had their various gods and goddesses, right? And this, again, is where Herman Bovink, who died in 1921, great Dutch theologian, he said, quote, "History is unable to show us in any age in which man lived without religion," unquote. And here's an example of that, right? These people being religious. And that religion is universal then among every tribe in the history of humanity. Some form of religion is there in every tribe of humanity, in the history of the world. It shows us, as Bovink says, that, quote, religion is rooted in the essence of human nature itself, unquote. It's rooted in the very essence of human nature itself, and we see this among these people groups, these civilizations at that time. That a supreme being exists and deserves to be worshipped. The question is, what's the character of that being? Is it just one or many? Now, there are skeptics to the universal argument for the existence of God. Skeptics respond and they say, oh, the idea of God's existence is a disease of the mind, a pathological condition of man's mind. Well, Bovink responds to that and he says this, if human nature cannot be trusted in respect to this universal consent, it is untrustworthy in every respect, unquote. It's a universal consent of mankind. We agree there's a supreme being to be worshipped. Every tribe evidences that. Just like every group knows that 1 + 1 = 2. Great minds are out there, yes, as outliers, I understand. Just like there's a depraved mind atheist out there, here and there. But every tribe, in general broad brush, what we find, historically, in the study of anthropology, every tribe is religious among mankind. If you can't trust them in that, what can you trust them in? Is the response. Then you can't trust the human mind in anything, is what Bovink would say. Well, Romans 1:18-32 is clearly displayed by these civilizations. The Mycenaean civilization in Greece, the Minoan civilization on Crete, Hittite civilization in Asia Minor, and the Egyptian civilization along the Nile River. What have they done? We know based on Romans 1:18-32. It's sinful pride and rebellion. They've refused to honor God and give thanks. They've refused to worship the Creator, the single Creator of heaven and earth. And what have they done? They've exchanged His glory with creatures, with various creaturely images and characteristics. So studying this period of history, the Apostle Paul understood Greco-Roman history. Okay? And as we will see, there were a couple Greek historians, Herodotus and Thucydides, who in the 400s were writing about this period of time, of the Mycenae period, speculating what happened. Okay, the Apostle Paul, he was a reader, he was knowledgeable, he knew of what the Greco-Roman people believed in their history. But he explains to us in Romans 1:18-32 how to look at it from a biblical perspective. How to make sense of all of this paganism. All of this plethora of gods and goddesses. Now, before 1200 BC, in the late Bronze Age, trade flourished in the eastern Mediterranean Sea, between these main civilizations, okay? Between these main civilizations, these four main ones, of the Mycenae civilization, the Minoans, the Hittite, and the Egyptians, along with smaller people groups at that time, the Canaanites, Assyrians, Babylonians, more along Mesopotamia, east of the Canaanites, and then the Cypriots, little island of Cyprus, east of Crete, the island of Crete. And they were all involved in this international trade taking place at that time. And it was huge. And the greatest evidence of the prolific trade between these civilizations was discovered in a Bronze Age shipwreck that was discovered off the coast of Turkey, off the southern coast of Turkey in 1982. And this shipwreck, because of all of the items found on it, archaeologists look at pottery and all sorts of different things, right? But they could, basically, that shipwreck is dated to around 1300 BC. Okay, so the late Bronze Age. You said the Bronze Age is roughly 3300 BC to 1200 BC. So this shipwreck that was discovered by a scuba diver in 1982 off the southern coast of Turkey, present-day Turkey, which means off of Asia Minor at that time. So down here. And this shipwreck shows that the goods that were aboard that ship were from an area over 5 million square miles of trade. Where did these goods come from? There was a whole bunch of copper and tin, as you would expect, because it was the Bronze Age. Bronze is made out of copper and tin. What's fascinating is that most in this area that we're looking at, of the Eastern Mediterranean, most had to import the copper and tin to make bronze. And that'll play a role of what happens after the Bronze Age if this trade collapses. You depend upon the copper and tin to smelt it, heat it up, melt it, smelt it, and make your bronze for your weapons of war and your tools. Well, there's a whole bunch. I mean, there was tonnage on the ship of copper and tin. But there was a whole bunch of other items. Listen to this. This is what James Rickards wrote about it. The shipwreck was at the center of a complex supply chain stretching from modern Sudan, Africa, to Sweden, Scandinavian area, right, north of Europe, and from Sicily, the island south of Italy, to Syria, an area of over 5 million square miles. Goods on the ship were also carried from the Baltic. You know, the Baltic, so you got the northeast part of Europe, or the Red Sea. So goods from the Baltic and the Red Sea also were found on this ship. Baltic, northeast part of Europe, Sweden, right? Northwest of Europe, all the way down from Africa, from the Red Sea, all across. And some had to go by land to get to ports at the Mediterranean to be able to be put on a ship. Now, significantly, the more each civilization depended on imports for their economy, the more susceptible they were to an economic collapse if trade collapsed. Think about that a minute. So higher interconnectedness in trade creates more interdependency, right? So you're more vulnerable, actually, if your supply chains are disrupted. If your society is all depending on these imports of goods from all over the place, not just the money you're going to get from exports, whatever pottery and other things you're producing or mining, but imports, your economy needs these, you have to get copper and tin to make bronze. You don't get that, you don't eventually you don't have your tools and your weapons of war. Well, you can see how scholars were studying this period of time with what happened with us with COVID 4 years ago. I have a couple books on my shelf dealing with this period of time because there's some resemblance, because you have this prolific international trade, supply chains all over the 5 million square miles supporting these civilizations. And yet something happened. So one scholar of ancient Greece is one of the leading scholars in the world. He's got a book dealing with this date, 1177 BC. Before it, and he's got two books on it, and after it. And this is where I think it could very well be when God has his 10 plagues against Egypt and is bringing out Israel, is to say, well, what if it was 12 generations before Solomon began building the temple in 966 BC, and you'd put 20 years rather than 40 for each generation, and you end up with 240 years prior, which puts you right at this point. When God is dealing a great judgment against these civilizations, weakening them, at the very point he's going to bring his people to the land of promise against the Canaanites. Isn't that fascinating? It is. I haven't read anyone that connected it. It's just me thinking through this, going, this to me is fascinating. Because I see the logical connection, don't you? Around 1177 BC, this prosperous trade collapsed. This prosperous trade collapsed. And they call it, many scholars call it, a perfect storm of calamities. Perfect storm of calamities. Now, wouldn't it make sense for God, the ruler of heaven and earth, to bring a perfect storm of calamities against all these civilizations, take them out at the knees when he's going to bring his people to the land of Canaan to make sure they don't mess with Israel at that time? Very possible. Let's say it's possible. So what were the calamities? There were several. From about 1225 BC to around 1175 BC, there were a series of earthquakes that's struck the area. Now, I put the area on the board. What do I mean by that? What I mean by that is these earthquakes struck the whole mainland of Greece and all around the Aegean Sea and the eastern Mediterranean. The whole region of the eastern Mediterranean, around the Aegean Sea and all of Greece, suffered severe earthquakes such that it even destroyed some cities over that roughly 50-year period of time. Archaeologists know this. Now, there is what's called the Dorian invasion. This Dorian invasion of outsiders is with outsiders from the north. This is dealing with Greece. There's dispute, I put on the board, dispute whether it was before or after the collapse of the Mycenae. So in Greece, the Mycenae civilization controlled it. But did the Dorian invasion of these people from the north, and were part of the causing the collapse by invading from the north, or were they opportunists who came in after the collapse to say, oh, there's these empty areas now after the collapse, and then they were opportunists that came in? Herodotus and Thucydides were two Greek historians in the 400s who wrote about the Dorian invasion, speculating that these people from the north, they were thinking that they were part of the cause of the collapse of the Mycenae civilization. Scholars today in our day tend to look at it as these were more opportunists who came in after the collapse. So that one's, there's dispute on that one. And I'm going to be telling you why in a minute, why there's dispute. Okay. Internal rebellions is another one, another calamity that was taking place at this time. Again, they were all monarchies. Monarchies. There was a possible outbreak of the plague, you find among scholarship at this time. So again, this is around 1177 BC. There's very strong evidence of a mega drought in the entire region of the eastern Mediterranean from about 1250 BC to around 1100 BC. 150 years of a mega drought during that period of time, which then could play a role with internal rebellions if they're dependent as subjects to the king in this vast redistributive economic system. And then you have this mega drought, so it's hard to produce crops, and the king doesn't have much to give you to meet your food and necessities. Now again, the mega drought, you think, is for 150 years, 1250 BC to 1100 BC, and you think you, in the middle of this, you got 50 years of a series of earthquakes as well in that whole region from 1225 BC to 1175 BC. So after that 50-year period of earthquakes, in the middle of the mega drought, you could have certainly internal rebellions. And if the middle of that as well, you have an outbreak of the plague, these civilizations are collapsing. And all these calamities then together caused what is known as the Dark Age in Greece. The Dark Age of Greece. You say, how is it we went from all these to the Mycenae of this monarchy and this vast redistributive economic system where all the resources are owned by the king, everyone's just a subject, and you depend upon the king to distribute to you your food necessities, to getting to where we have ancient Greek city-states that govern themselves with republics? Well, a perfect storm of calamities in God's providence. This is what took out the Mycenae civilization. It ended. Now, some of the other civilizations were severely curtailed, but still continued. But the Mycenae civilization in Greece ended because of these calamities. And we ended up with what is known as the Dark Age in Greece from about 1000 BC to 750 BC. So these calamities, you think, okay, they're waving through the area, and then by 1000 BC, you've lost civilization. It is dark. So for 250 years, from 1000 BC to 750 BC. Again, remember, the archaic age in ancient Greece was 750 BC to 500 BC. Okay? Right? And then the classical period from 500 BC to 323 BC. So the dark age in Greece is from about 1000 BC. After all these calamities, you've lost civilization. And that's for 250 years, roughly, before you begin the archaic age of ancient Greece at 750, roughly. Okay. And the first 100 years were intense of the Dark Age in Greece. So from about 1000 BC to 900 BC, it was intense. Where Greece experienced a massive reduction in trade, severe depopulation, and reduced agriculture. Massive reduction in trade, severe depopulation of the area, and reduced agriculture. And historical evidence suggests they may even have lost their knowledge of writing. So we talked about the Linear B tablets, right, with the one scholar looking at the gods and goddesses. But the evidence, the historical evidence suggests they lost the ability to write. That they lost their knowledge of writing in this period. And why do we say that? Where they lost their knowledge of writing? During this period, during the Dark Age, from 1000 BC to 750, essentially no written records exist. Almost no written records exist from that whole 250-year period. The Mycenae civilization ended. So then you say, okay, well, what did happen in that period? There's no written records. If you don't have written records, how do you know, right? Well, this is where, of those that survived and stayed, there were oral traditions, right? How are things passed from one generation to another? So my parents, roughly 20 years older than me, right? This is where generations are basically 20 years. if nothing's in writing, how do you carry on traditions and beliefs, your religious beliefs, right? Your practices, your values. How do you do it? You do it orally. You tell your stories. To say, this is what happened to great-great-grandpa, and this is what they did then, and this is the wars they had, and this is the heroes of that day, and you name it, right? You have oral traditions. But again, this is where you get to more of a prehistoric society for a period of time. Nothing's in writing. It was a dark age. Any cultural traditions, values, beliefs were transmitted orally then over those generations for the 250 years. So this is where we get to, and I'm flying along pretty good in my notes, by the way. This is where we get to the early Greek poets. Now again, I wrote up my notes for this on Monday and Thursday of this week. I've been thinking about it, you know, since the last time we met, putting it together, reading lots of things, and you're thinking, okay, what are the main things to see the flow, the survey of thought, the flow of history, to understand how we get into the culture of ancient Greece in the archaic period and the classical Greek period? You cannot understand it unless you understand this Mycenae civilization and what happened to it. And then how certain religious beliefs and traditions were preserved by the poets. Homer and Hesiod. So this is where we're flowing into the early Greek poets. Well, the poets were writers. Right? So if we say in the Dark Age of Greece, because of all these calamities, after 1177 BC, especially, but the Dark Age of Greece, heavy from 1000 BC to 750 BC, for 250 years, they lost their knowledge of writing. They could only transmit their religious beliefs and history and values through oral traditions. Any that survived in states, okay. They had to have adopted another language. It's really for writing. And this is what happened. From about 950 BC to around 750 BC, in that period of time, somewhere in that period of time, during the Dark Age of Greece, the Greeks adopted a Phoenician alphabet. And you say, well, who are they? Who are the Phoenicians? Well, they were a group of people on the eastern Mediterranean coast. People traveled by ship, right? There was still interaction. Massive reduction in trade, but doesn't mean your trade is zero. Still have some interaction with other people groups. Well, the Greeks adopted a Phoenician alphabet from a group of people on the eastern Mediterranean coast. And what's interesting about that alphabet is they represented vowels as letters. And we have vowels A, E, I, O, U, and Y sometimes. They represented vowels as letters. And what's interesting is our English alphabet is based upon this alphabet that the Greeks adopted from the Phoenicians at the end of the Dark Age. And you can see it the way some of their letters are in the Greek language, of having their vowels represented by letters. So in a certain sense, then, you've got a little nugget of something. We're talking about America and Western civilization, of something we got from the ancient Greeks in our English alphabet. Right? So they're, in a sense, then they're a part of Western civilization. Right? In that sense, just in a small way, in that sense. Even though the big thing of why they're included is because of their republican forms of governments that they'll eventually form. And we learn a lot about what not to do from them. So the Greeks, as they refer to themselves as the Hellenes, they slowly began to re-inhabit Greece from about 750 BC to 500 BC. And that's the period we've called the Archaic Age, Greece. It's where they're re-inhabiting the area after the Dark Age and all those calamities that destroyed the Mycenae civilization. What I want you to note is during this Archaic Age of Greece, from about 750 BC to 500 BC, this is where some 1,500 different city-states randomly formed across Greece. And they were small. Most were small, a few thousand people. Now, they were just randomly people moving into these. Part of it is to understand the geography, okay, of ancient Greece. This is a good time to say it, too, is that in Greece, it's a mountainous area with valleys all over. So the valleys are ideal for farming and agriculture, or your some grain crops and your olives and grapes. And yet they're sectioned off by mountains, in a sense. So they're dotted valleys all over this mountainous area. So then when people go back to re-inhabit, they're kind of in an isolated pocket. In an isolated pocket. So Sparta will be in a valley. Okay? So they're in isolated areas, and usually many have access to the sea then for trade, where the valley goes down or a river goes down to the sea. But then they're in a valley, and they're kind of isolated from somebody else who's over the mountain pass where there's another city. So they're isolated, and part of the geography then encouraged these 1,500 different isolated settlements and cities. You get me? So that's in God's providence as well. It wasn't intentional. It's just something that, because of the geography, this is what happened after the Dark Age and the collapse of the Mycenae civilization. But just people then setting up their farms and start growing crops, and then they start associating with one another and then start saying, okay, we should have some laws and we should, you know, start putting things down. And they were right in writing, right? And this is where they have the Phoenician alphabet. They have a new written language. And we'll move into, Lord willing, through the laws that were there in many of the Greek city-states. You can't have the rule of law unless you have written laws. That's something to remember, too, which we had in Israel, in Jerusalem. So this is when, through this, you see this history then of how did God get rid of the monarchy and the vast redistributive economic system of the Mycenae civilization. Well, it was through all these calamities, and then through the Greek Dark Age, the Dark Age of Greece, and then through the random just people coming back and re-inhabiting it through the Archaic Age from 750 BC to 500 BC, and you end up with these roughly 1,500 different separate communities governing themselves. Now, some of them did. We'll look at that. Some of them did have their own little monarchies. But many had oligarchies where the wealthiest kind of got together to govern things. And then in Athens, more set up a democracy. But we'll look at some of that, Lord willing, when we get to that point in history. So, if you were to summarize it in short, this is where some scholars will say, Victor Davis Hanson being one of them, some scholars will say that civilization began to reemerge in ancient Greece after 800 BC. That's what some of them will say. It's when civilization began to reemerge in ancient Greece after 800 BC. At the very end of the Dark Age of Greece, which was 1000 BC to 750 BC. Interestingly, the traditional date for the first Olympic Games was 776 BC. Right, just after civilization is beginning to reemerge in Greece, right? Just before the beginning of the Archaic Age of ancient Greece. It goes from 750 to 500 BC. Let me just say, too, Mount Olympus, I said it just briefly, I think, at the beginning, but Mount Olympus is the highest mountain in Greece, and it's kind of the northeast part of Greece. Mount Olympus is kind of up in this area, on the west side of the Aegean Sea. It's the highest mountain and very important for their Greek mythology. One thing I wanted to say on the gods and goddesses, just to add another point on that, is, and we'll get to more of that the next time we meet, but just, they had, many of them had human characteristics, many of them married, many of them gave birth, many of them had sinful characteristics, like Zeus was known to have mistresses, cheating on his wife, and he'd always try and cheat on his wife in their marriage. This was their supposed gods and goddesses, and yet he'd get caught, and the Greeks would laugh at that, you know. And it's really, in a certain sense, glorified human beings. Had a lot of human characteristics with men and women, and are sinful characteristics, as we are sinful. Okay, I had mentioned that in the Mycenaean civilization that existed in the late Bronze Age in Greece, that they had many gods and goddesses with the same names that the ancient Greeks of the Archaic period and the Classical period also had. But we went through this whole Dark Age, 250 years of Dark Age, where they even lost their writing, their knowledge of writing. And the only way they could carry that through is with oral traditions, right? Oral transmission, oral communication. And this is where we get to the poets of Homer and Hesiod, who both of them wrote their writings, their epic poems. Scholars estimate between 750 and 700. There's debate on some of that because they don't know. It's early history in ancient Greek. Best I can see from the scholarship is that Homer and Hesiod both wrote their epic poems between 750 and 700 BC. And I'm going to explain, both of them are looking back before 1200 BC to the Mycenae civilization, and really right around the beginning of the calamities, 1184 BC, right around 1200 BC, at the very end of the Mycenae civilization. Because it's the calamities that were occurring 1177 on, that brought the end of the Mycenae civilization. So if, as we will see with Homer's Iliad, with the Trojan War, and it probably occurred in 1184 BC, you're right there at the beginning of the calamities, eventually when the Mycenae civilization will end. So let's talk a little bit about these poems, but to think in your mind, these poets writing between 750 and 700 are writing about events that occurred about 400 years earlier. And the only way they could know about them is through oral communication. Oral transmission, generation to generation to generation. Is my granddad told my granddad, told my granddad, told my granddad, told my granddad, told my granddad about what happened with the Trojan War. And the gods and goddesses of that day and the heroes of that day. That's what we have with the Greek poets. So Homer wrote his epic poems, the Iliad and the Odyssey, between 750 and 700 BC. Homer's Iliad is set during the Trojan War. During the Trojan War, he's focusing on the final weeks of the Mycenaean military effort. He's focusing on the Trojan War. What do we mean by Trojan War? It's to take the city of Troy. Right? Where I told you the city of Troy is that northeast part of the Aegean Sea, east of Greece. So it's during the final weeks of the Mycenaean military effort to overtake the city of Troy. This is where scholars believe the Trojan War took place between 1346 BC to 1127 BC. That's a pretty big span of time. When you know, roughly 200 years, they're not sure. But scholarship says the best estimate is 1184 BC for the Trojan War, which puts you then right at the beginning of the calamities and toward the very end of the Mycenae civilization. They're writing roughly four centuries after the Trojan War, following oral transmissions of the war, along with the religious beliefs and values during that time of the Trojan War, and they put it into writing. So you have the gods and goddesses which enter into Homer's Iliad, which get involved in human affairs. That's big among the Greeks. They do acknowledge, in a sense, certain providence, that the gods and goddesses are active in human affairs. But again, those gods and goddesses are sinful. The Greek mythology is what we'll focus on the next time we meet. You know, I'm not going to get into all the debate on Homer's Iliad, but he includes, like archaeologists know what the warriors wore at the time of the Mycenae civilization. Their helmets and different, what they were shaped like in that. So the way he describes things, he's going to that period of time, and this is where they're trying to figure out the date, right? But then they know that he also includes some things that seem to be of the 700s. So there's a certain sense, how much, is it historical fiction? He's writing an epic poem. And like historical fiction, where some is history, but some is fiction. And it seems like it may be that from scholarship with Homer's Iliad. So I'm sure they, as you say, had accurate oral transmissions because it was the thing. It was the only thing they had. And yet he's a poet, right? Yeah, he's taking poetic license with it and including some things, perhaps their current time period. Now, what's fascinating is I didn't say it, there's a lot that could be said on it, but in Homer's Iliad, the characters that are in it, he picks characters that are from various places across this whole area of Greece. So the people reading it across Greece is like, oh, they know this area and this region and there, and this person's from there, and then they're all together, they're fighting over here to take Troy, which is kind of interesting. But that's a way of Homer's Iliad also attracting a great reading audience when you've got characters from all across Greece in the epic poem, which is kind of interesting. The other one that he wrote was Homer's Odyssey, and that's about a king and his effort for 10 years to return home after the Trojan War. So probably in that same period of time then, but 1184 then to after the Trojan War, for 10 years once it finished, And again, the Iliad is in the final weeks of the Trojan War. Okay? Homer's Iliad is in the final weeks of the Trojan War. They think 1184 was the date on that. But then he writes this Odyssey about the adventures of this king that was involved in the Trojan War to take Troy, and his adventures trying to get back home for 10 years to get back home with his family. He is from an island just west of Greece. He was the king of Attica. King of Attica. But that's where you have different characters again from different places across Greece. But in both of his epic poems, there's mythical stories of gods and goddesses with human characteristics and with sinful characteristics, but how they were actively involved in human affairs. This is a part of their culture, the cult, the religious devotion and worship of a people group. Okay? So then when you're reading Romans 1, 18 to 32, you're thinking about the Greco-Roman history. This is part of all of that, paganism. Rome carries that over, all these gods and goddesses as well. And we'll look at that. And they changed some names of some of them, but they liked them. Hesiod is another early Greek poet, and he wrote his two epic poems, Theogony and Works and Days, also between 750 and 700 BC is the best estimate, as I said. Theogony dealt predominantly with the origin and activities of the mythical gods and goddesses. How did they come to be? It's really a very theological work. A work of heresy, yes. A work of idolatry, yes. But it's a theological work. And his other epic poem is Works and Days, and that covered the agricultural life of the poor peasants. This is what one scholar wrote about Hesiod's writings, that they, quote, were meant to teach lessons about the role of the gods in human life, the nature of justice, and the problems created by the inequalities of power as the Greeks slowly developed new forms of political and social life in their city-states, unquote. I'll read it again. Hesiod's writings, quote, were meant to teach lessons about the role of the gods in human life, the nature of justice, and the problems created by the inequalities of power as the Greeks slowly developed new forms of political and social life in their city-states, unquote. In the end, really, you know, I cannot for the life of me remember where I read this, but Homer and Hesiod can be considered, in a sense, the priests of the Greek religion. And I searched through my books like crazy trying to find, I cannot remember where I read it. I read so many things. But it's a way of looking at these two poets, these early Greek poets, as the priests, because their writings were read all the way through. They were quoted all the way through. They were studied all the way through. This is the age of heroes and heroism and all of their gods and goddesses that will be their Greek city-states had their gods and goddesses and mythical religion a part of their legal systems. Their calendars and holidays were around their gods and goddesses. Festivals had gods and goddesses. It was really tied with their culture in lots of ways. Lord willing, we'll say more about that the next time we meet with Greek mythology. But as well, later on, I want to move into the philosophers and as well move into the republics and their various laws that they had in there. Because I have a collection as well as the laws that they had in their ancient Greek city-states. It's real fascinating to read through. Listen to this. This is what one scholar said. That the religious ideas in these epic poems, so when you think of Homer's Iliad and the Odyssey and Hesiod's Theogony and Works and Days, but in these poems, the religious ideas, quote, became something of a standard for Greek religion, poetry, and art, unquote. Became a standard. So from here forward, for the Archaic Age, 750 to 500 BC, and then the Classical Age, 500 BC to 323 BC, this was the standard for religion. Now remember, as we said, the philosophers chose a different route. They rejected the mythical gods and goddesses. They were scientists, remember, natural philosophers. So you have this great debate that will enter among the ancient Greeks once the philosophers arise. But all along, the people always had these mythical gods and goddesses that go back to the early Greek poets in the 750 to 700 BC of Homer and Hesiod. These poets are writing about events that occurred about 400 years earlier. And the only way they could know about them is through oral communication. This is where they take great pride in this long history of their mythical gods and goddesses that you see. And that's what we'll get into in Greek mythology the next time we meet. Lord willing.